and welcome to another very special edition of The Boarding Pass with Ken Weeb and myself, Murad Atesh, as always. Today, we're excited to welcome I guess he's turning into a little bit of a The Athletic all-star in that we were able to feature a little bit of his work last week at The Athletic. It was Grant Klitsam. Grant, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
And before we get to welcoming you fully, talking about, you know, what you're up to today as the director of career transition for of After the Game at One Sports and Entertainment, I got to do my weekly check-in with Ken. Ken, I miss you. How are you? How was your long weekend? Are things good?
Yeah, absolutely, Murat. Yes, no complaints whatsoever. Got the patio furniture out, enjoyed a couple of walks outdoors, and definitely finished off the old Last Dance documentary. I know you got close to the end. I won't spoil the finish for you, but just a tremendous piece of journalism, and into season 5 of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So good little viewing, got the exercise going, and keeping the joy level up.
Yes, 9-9. I have 2 episodes left of The Last Dance. And I've just been glued to that thing. I gotta say, I love, you know, whatever the behind the scenes stories are. I just love behind the scenes views of greatness wherever I can find it. Grant, what about yourself? Have you been on The Last Dance binge, or what are you getting up to right now during pandemic times?
I have, actually. First of all, Ken, I like that Joy in Your Life reference. It sounds like a Claude Noel reference there, Shooter. What a great guy he is. I've been watching The Last Dance, and yeah, I think like everybody else, just glued to the TV when it's on. So impressive on so many different levels. Listening to some of the stories from people I know of him on the golf course, and it's pretty impressive to see. But I haven't seen the last 2 episodes either, so I appreciate the no spoiler alerts.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. You're a gentleman.
We're here to do our best. Yeah, we're doing our best. How about you? Just personally, Grant, I mean, you got a young family. I mean, what's it been like to juggle parenting and a couple of different business ventures during the pause here?
Yeah, it's been interesting. My job that I'm doing right now with One Sports, I'm working from home, so that really hasn't changed a whole lot. But what has changed is having my whole family at home with me while I'm trying to work, so that can make things quite challenging. Obviously no schools and no daycares, anything like that going on right now. So on the bright side, everyone's healthy, we're all doing good, and we're just trying to look at the positives, and I think that although it's challenging now, you know, hopefully we'll be looking back in 6 months or a year and say how lucky we were to have that time together as a family and really just spend all that time together. So we've just been trying to do different things. Now that it's getting warmer and nicer outside in Ottawa where I am, we're getting outside a lot more, going for bike rides. I like to bike kind of on my own too for exercise. So that's helping me get out of the house and going to do that, and trying to stay active. And aside from that, I mean, just making sure everybody's getting some time to themselves, some space to themselves, and just trying to stay positive. But like I said, I can't really complain because everybody's healthy, and things could be a lot worse.
That sounds so wise. I think of, you know, my favorite people in the universe to spend, you know, my close family 24/7 without those breaks, without that chance to go for a bike on your own or a walk on your own or whatever it is. I imagine the novelty would wear off, but with a good amount of balance, I feel like this whole process is manageable. Have you found yourself discovering any like strange hobbies or new games with the kids that you weren't aware of before this? Because everybody's got their own rabbit hole.
Well, one thing we're trying to be really cognizant of is the screen time and the TV. And I think it's so easy to just say, all right, buddy, go turn on the TV. And then we can do some of our own things and get some work done, send some emails, make some calls. But, you know, it's a slippery slope. And before you know it, that screen time starts piling up. So we're trying to, you know, do puzzles, and we get homework sent over from the teachers and do some homework. I mean, at the age they're at now, it's pretty basic stuff, some coloring and some letters and writing and stuff like that, but it's still great for them to kind of stimulation and get their imagination going. We've been doing a lot of stuff outside though. We just got a bird feeder from my parents and set it up, and the kids have just been absolutely amazed by this bird feeder. So one of them will sit in the window and start pounding the window every time there's a bird. We have to come over and look. The other one sneaks and crawls in the grass and tries to catch the birds, which obviously has no success doing, but it's entertaining and it keeps them busy. And what else? I pulled the trigger on a play structure. I was adamant against it because we live really close to a park, but with everything going on and the parks being closed, and so we went on Costco's website and pulled the trigger, and that was a fun project in itself. Actually, it took about 3 or 4 days to put together, but it's together now and it's keeping the kids busy and serving its purpose. So yeah, we're pretty good. We're in a good spot.
The beauty of engineering. We'll definitely get into the article that Murat wrote in the Q&A in there with what you're up to now. But Grant, for yourself personally, I mean, how did you come to grips with having to retire early? Obviously, the circumstances were tough, probably playing some of the best hockey of your career, and then a back injury. You had other ideas.
Yeah, challenging for sure. I mean, right from an early stage, I kind of looked at it as, okay, I could sit here and feel sorry for myself and imagine all the things that could have been or would have been if I stayed healthy, and think about the potential success I might have had, or the career I would have had. Or I can look at it as being really fortunate for the opportunity I had and the chance of a lifetime to play in the NHL, and all the people that I met, and the great friendships that I made, and the life skills that I learned, and just the experience that I was fortunate enough to live. I think, so many people dream of playing in the NHL, and I had that chance, and it was incredible. It was everything I'd hoped for and more. And so I really tried to take that approach right from the get-go, because I felt personally that it would be a slippery slope if I started those negative thoughts and started thinking about what if, what if, what if. And I can't control that. And unfortunately, I got hurt, and it is what it is. It happened. So I have to kind of just take stock of where I'm at and move forward. And so that's what I tried to do. I stayed in touch with a lot of my teammates and a lot of friends, and had some great support from Mark Chipman and Chevy and Paul. They are all very supportive, and I think it was just great to kind of still feel connected in a certain way. But I knew at that point that it was time to start a new part of my life and figure out what that was, and and just try and stay busy and stimulated. And I knew I wouldn't accomplish anything by sitting down and feeling sorry for myself, and probably would have drove my family nuts. So I just tried to stay busy, and it was a tough time. I think for me, you're going through the change and the big life change of no longer playing hockey. But what made it difficult for me too, I think, was just my limitations physically as well. With my back injury, I couldn't use that as an outlet to kind of get through the mental hurdles, or the challenge of it. So I couldn't go and kill myself in the gym, or go on nonstop bike rides or runs or whatever it is I needed to do. And so it was kind of like a bit of a double whammy. But on the positive, we had just had our first son. We kind of settled back in Ottawa, so it was really good to be around when he was born, and he was just such a good distraction for me. And so many people don't have the luxury of being around when their kids are that young and being able to spend time with their family like that. So I'm very fortunate that I had the luxury to be able to do that, and hopefully that's, will create a lifelong strong bond with my kids. And and then from there it was staying busy. So that's what I tried to do.
How did you get from the initial sort of making sure you stay busy period to choosing an MBA and eventually sort of plotting the route that would become your future?
So, I'm a big believer in just trying things, and that's what I tried to do. So the path was kind of I'd started taking wine courses in Winnipeg, actually, at Banville and Jones, doing WSET, and I really enjoyed it. I've always liked wine, but I also really like kind of the geography and the history and the culture that is associated with wine and winemaking countries. And so that led me to, when we moved back to Ottawa, I went to community college here, Algonquin College, and did the sommelier program, which, again, super interesting. And then just so happened that at that time, I was doing sommelier. I was back home in Ottawa. My in-laws had purchased an apple orchard and farm. And so we started talking. We said, why don't we try and make some cider? So I thought, cool, that sounds fun and exciting. And so then I went to England, took some cider maker courses to really understand how to do it. And, you know, if I was going to jump into this, I wanted to know what I was doing. And we hired an enologist in Quebec to help guide us, which an enologist is somebody who has a degree in winemaking. So they're the brains behind the operation, but I wanted to be able to speak a little bit of the lingo. And then once we started doing that, it kind of snowed to a business. So we had to, you know, think about acquiring equipment to equipment we needed and how we could structure operations in a way to be profitable and how we were going to sell it and how we're going to market it and price it and distribution. And so it was really like, you know, when you start a small family business, you're wearing a lot of different hats, and that quickly piqued my interest in business. And I had a degree in business from when I went to Clarkson before I played pro hockey, and always kind of thought about doing my MBA. And it was a natural step for me. It just, I had the time, and I figured I had still a lot of years left in me to work and to really put my MBA to work. So I wasn't even sure if I'd be able to get in. So I called a bunch, like three or four different universities, and kind of told them my story before I even applied and said, is it worth me trying to apply? And all of them were pretty enthusiastic. So I applied, and I went to Queen's and Kingston and did my MBA there. So that was kind of the natural progression for me. I kind of went from an interest in wine to then trying to make cider, and then from there starting the family business, and then to further piquing my interest in business, and it got me into the MBA, and then now I'm doing what I'm doing now.
The thing that I always realized and enjoyed about our discussions, Grant, when you were playing, I mean, you always had interests outside of hockey, whether it was politics or, as you mentioned, business. I mean, were there some applicable skills from your hockey playing days that were helpful in, you know, pursuing those business interests and your MBA in particular?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And so many that you don't really realize. I think it's easy as an athlete to really get kind of focused in your bubble, and your whole life becomes on being the best athlete you can be, and being, in my case, the best defenseman I could be, and trying to make the teams I wanted to make, and then trying to establish myself on those teams, and then trying to get more ice time, earning the trust and confidence in my coaching staff and my teammates. And so you just kind of get caught up in this this routine or this bubble of your world, and you don't realize, I guess, all the skills you're learning while you're doing all that. And so that, I think, really came to light when I did my MBA. And a huge part of the MBA program at Queen's is groups, is teams. So from the first day you get there, you're placed in a group. Usually it's based on geography, but you're placed in a group of anywhere from 5 to 8 students. And you actually spend your whole 2-year program with these same students. So half the assignments, half the projects are group-based, and then the other half are individual. So over that course of time working with the same people, it's kind of like being around a sports team where you start to understand dynamics and personalities and strengths and weaknesses. And there's ample opportunity to have disagreements and, you know, highs and lows and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's where it really stood out to me, where I'd been in situations where I have to learn how to deal with stressful situations or deadlines or high pressure, high stakes, being able to think on the fly, being able to recognize other people's strengths and how we can fit those into this group. How can we make those strengths work in this team to make the overall team better? And, you know, time management, structure, discipline, I think hard work kind of goes without saying. So it's just all those skills that you develop as a high performing individual or an athlete or, you know, someone who's in this system, that you can then take and translate those into anything else, really.
One of the things that we talked about a little bit for the piece that went up at The Athletic, talking about helping players transition and go through a similar journey to what you did, was the amount of confidence that you found while you were studying at Queens, when you realized that, hey, I can hold a conversation with the VPs and with the CEOs and with people with all sorts of different backgrounds. Are you able to talk a little bit about sort of reclaiming your confidence in a different field?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, I guess the start of that was really when I was even thinking about applying for university, because I had done my undergrad degree at Clarkson. I graduated in 2008. So I'd been out of school for 10 years. And here I was thinking about going back into school. And by the traditional definition, I didn't really have a lot of work experience. I mean, yeah, I'd been around internships and yeah, I'd had summer jobs and I'd been around sports my whole life. I'd seen some of the business side of sports through the union and through, you know, just some of the things that go on day to day, but you're not really exposed to that much real work experience, so to speak. So right away, I thought, like, do I even have the requirements to get into this program? And that's when I started to realize, okay, well, there is a lot of value placed in the experiences I have had. So how can I then use those experiences to build my confidence and shape kind of the professional I want to become outside of sports and kind of redefine my identity a little bit? And I mean, at the end of the day, sports and hockey is always going to be a big part of my identity and a big part of who I am. It's shaped my life. It's given me everything I have. So I totally embrace it, but I think I can be more than just a hockey player, just an athlete. And that's kind of my message to a lot of the players that I talk to, is just, you know, I think the focus has to be on hockey and your sport, because that's who you are. That's what you know. And you've worked your whole life to get to this point, but that doesn't mean that you can't do things outside of that, that can be totally different than hockey and that won't have a negative impact on your career. And so that's what I tried to do when I got into Queens. And I got there, I mean, the first day I was super nervous. It was almost like, you know, going to training camp, the first day training camp, where you're at a new team and you don't know anybody there, and you have fitness testing and you're looking around, you're kind of sizing everybody up. And, you know, you see Thorburn with his biceps bulging through his t-shirt, and you see, you know, Slater ripping down the sprints, and you see Buff walking around, and you're thinking, like, man, these guys are going to kill me. But quickly you start to realize that, okay, no, I did pretty good on that bench test. I did pretty good on the sprint test, and I can hold my weight. And it's those experiences, those, whether they're successes or failures, I think, but it's that life experience that gives you that confidence. And so that's, I guess, how I had related. So the same thing, my first couple of days at Queens, you're kind of sizing people up and you're looking at these established executives that are VPs or high level managers and in completely different fields, but very successful people and very driven, very motivated, but that have been working in business for 5, 10, 15, some 20 years. So it was a bit intimidating. But then, like I said, back to the team part, that's when you start to realize, okay, if I can learn these business skills and I can learn the language and learn how to think, I have a lot of other skills that I think can help me excel also. So that's where I started to gain the confidence, was really just kind of getting my feet wet, getting in the mix, you know, putting in the work and then getting a couple positive results back from some assignments and professors and even teammates. And then it was just, the rest was history. I had my confidence and I could just build off that.
In some ways, it almost sounds like going back to when you finished at Clarkson and you know you had been drafted by Columbus, yes, but I mean you show up in Syracuse and you know you make your debut with Columbus and you go back to the minors, you get subjected to waivers. I mean, you dealt with a lot in your career. I mean, was that something you were able to lean on as well when you went back to being a student?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's also something I could lean on with my injury. I think dealing with this adversity is something I faced a decent amount of my career, and not trying to let anybody feel sorry for me at all, but I have had adversity through my career and challenges on making coaches or GMs or people kind of realize what I can do on the ice and how I can help a team, and building that trust and building that confidence and then feeling good, but then getting a setback, whether it's getting sent down or being a healthy scratch or sitting in the stands watching or putting on waivers, you name it. But what I tend to do in those situations, and maybe that's just because I've faced it enough in my career, I tend to use that as a motivator, as something to build off of, instead of, again, kind of the same situation when I had my injury, instead of saying, oh, no, it's not fair, you know, it's not my fault, sit back and take accountability and say, okay, well, why am I in this situation? What got me here and how do I get out of it? And how do I make sure it doesn't happen again? So yeah, definitely. I think that's just another great example, Ken, of how, you know, life in sports and athletics can help give you resiliency and deal with adversity and bring all those skills to other areas.
You know what I can't help but picture right now, and we all talked about The Last Dance before we started off, is Michael Jordan saying, hey, that made it personal. He looked at me the wrong way. That made it personal. He always took his game to another level. So I'm hearing you right now, Grant, being like, yeah, I got waived. I had to push up. That made it personal and all of that. But by your last stretch with the Jets, you were playing 20-plus minutes a night alongside Dustin Byfuglien, which I have to believe, looking back, must have been the top pairing at that time. What was that stretch like playing with a character as unique as he is in a role that was so substantial?
It was awesome. I mean, anytime as an athlete, as a competitor, and again, back to your MJ analogy, like you crave that competition. You want to be placed in, you want to be that guy who's on in overtime when your team needs to score. You want to be that guy who's killing the penalty with a minute left in the game to pull out the win. Like that's what you live for. That's your goal. So anytime you can play with a player like Buff and be playing those minutes and be playing those important situations, I mean, it was so fun. It was just so rewarding and it's just so much easier to get into the game too, because you're on all the time, you're playing against other teams' top lines, you really get into the competitive part of the game, and you know you're matched up against a certain player, so it really does become personal. You're always trying to shut that player down, and so it was so much fun. I mean, those days were great. Obviously, Buff is a character and a good friend, and someone that I had a lot of fun playing with, and he just helped keep things light. He helped take the pressure off by just his personality and knowing you could count on him. And I mean, he's so laid back that, like, I even remember times during the game where he would say stuff that you would just never expect somebody to say in a game, like maybe in practice joking around, but in a game, I remember one time we're on the point, and I kind of looked him off for a one-timer and passed it to somebody else. Might have been Wheels or something. And during the play, he's like, don't you ever do that again. Like half joking, kind of half serious too, right? But that's just who he was. That's just the kind of guy he was. And competitive and intense, but able to see the light and everything. And so, yeah, those days were a lot of fun. You know, we had some good teams, and playing those types of minutes with a player like that was awesome.
What was your introduction to Dustin Byfuglien, or that first moment where you saw his sense of humor maybe in the room? That, I mean, we've heard about it, but we don't necessarily see it. I mean, Josh Morrissey talked about how, you know, when they were scored on for the first time as a pairing, you said, well, kid, now you're officially in the NHL. You've been scored on. But how about for you?
That's a good question, because I mean, there's so many instances that I remember with Buff. Like, I mean, he's just a prankster in the dressing room too. Can't count the amount of water cups I had under my hockey helmet that just landed on my face when I went to go grab my helmet, and you know, hiding my sticks and stuff like that. Like, he just made it fun around the dressing room. But no, I remember he was very welcoming. The first time I rolled into the room, I mean, I played against Buff, and you know, he'd had a lot of success in the league. He was you know, a Stanley Cup champion, and obviously a big personality and a big guy. And he right away told me to sit beside him in the room, and we hit it off pretty quick. And it was just a lot of fun. I think he'll if you ask him, he's the reason why I got my last contract, because we were playing together. So I got a new contract, and just funny that he always likes to bug guys about, and makes it fun going to the rink.
Are you paying attention to the current Jets this year, as they've been sort of made to play without him helping them out?
I am a bit, yeah. I wouldn't say I follow them religiously, but you know, having still quite a few guys that I played with that are there, or guys that were kind of up and coming while I was there. If I'm watching any hockey, it's definitely the Jets.
What are your thoughts on the season they've had, Grant?
I think it's been pretty good. I mean, they got some good depth. I think, you know, their big forwards are scoring when they need them to score. But it's been a tight race, and it's such a competitive division, and it always has been. That central division is so tight. And, I mean, even, you know, looking now with kind of the stoppage in play, it's still pretty tight. And, you know, they got to... Well, I'm not sure what the format's going to be like when this does resume, if it does resume. But if it was a traditional format, they still have a great chance of making the playoffs, but they got some other teams pretty tight on them. So I think at the beginning of the year, obviously the big question mark was Buff, whether he was going to come back or not. And then once it was pretty clear that he wasn't coming back, that you know, some of the people in the league and whatever were saying how the decor was a little bit... maybe not as strong as they'd like it to be, especially coming off of previous years where they have like a Trouba, Myers, Buff, and, you know, pretty loaded back end. So, but, you know, it's kind of, it's those situations that I think allow players that might not be as well known or have such a high profile to really have the opportunity to show what they can do. And you've seen some of the defensemen this year, and how that decor has really come together. I think, you know, Pionk's been playing really good, and there's just, that's what happens, I think. When a guy like Buff falls out of the lineup, you get opportunity for new guys, and it's up to them. And that's their chance to establish themselves, and if they can take it and run, then great. And I think some of those D have done a good job with that.
Have you ever been able to describe chemistry to a non-professional athlete in terms of how to find it in those sort of circumstances?
How would I describe chemistry? I think chemistry gets developed when you're with a group of people through tough times and good times, and you can learn to count on those people and trust those people. And know that they're there to make the team better, and they're there to help you. You know, prime example of that would be as a player, if you have a bad game and you get one of your teammates grabs you after the game or between periods or whatever and says, "Hey, we got you tonight. Like, we know things aren't going well, but that's here to pick each other up." And ideally you want everybody going every night, but when it doesn't happen and you get that kind of teammate and that kind of, I guess, chemistry, it starts to build something. And then I think you get that comfort zone, you get that that ability to just know what to expect. Goes a long way.
Grant, let's go back to your Columbus days. I mean, Rick Nash is a guy that I covered two playoff series involving the New York Rangers after he made his switch with the trade. I mean, what was his leadership style like, and what'd you learn being around a high performance elite kind of athlete like him in Columbus?
Yeah, he's a guy that another like a great person, but just a quiet leader, kind of like Andrew Ladd a little bit in that sense, where they're not overly vocal in the room. but they do command a certain presence, and they do it with their play. And when I came into Columbus, Rick was fresh off winning a Canadian gold medal, and a guy who had been an all-star for numerous years and just a high profile player. So I was kind of unsure what it would be like, what the dynamic would be like, but just such a down to earth, humble, kind of easygoing guy that, just another normal guy in the dressing room. But on the ice, he just takes charge of games and takes control, and he's just so dominant when he wants to be. And then I remember there were times in the room where things are quiet, and then all of a sudden he does speak up and he is vocal. And that's when everybody's just like, whoa, okay, like Nasher's talking, we're listening. So I think he just had that, that respect, really, in my opinion, kind of a quiet leader, but, let his play do the talking, and, really, really smart hockey sense wise, and, really understood the game, and, just so good at making you feel like part of the team and comfortable. And I really enjoyed my time with Nasher.
Not an Olympic gold medalist quite yet, but a World Junior gold medalist, Robert Thomas of the St. Louis. Pardon me, Robert Thomas of the St. Louis Blues. I just got to let everybody know he's joining the We Went Blues podcast with Barrett Jackman and Jeremy Rutherford this week at The Athletic. Make sure to check that out. Grant, I'm wondering in terms of leadership styles, actually, because you compared a couple of them, what would Blake Wheeler's leadership style have been like at the time that you and him overlapped with Winnipeg?
So Blake was a bit different. He's much more vocal and really intense. I don't know if I want to compare him to Michael Jordan, but might go to his head a little bit. But I love Blake. He's a great guy, and he's just such a competitor. That's I think what drives him is his competitiveness. You see it in practice, you see it in games. He's intense. He puts in the work, and he makes sure his teammates are working. And I think that's important. I think if you can drive your teammates and make them better players, that's a good sign of a leader. And he does that. He's not complacent. He's not just going to go through the motions. When you're at game 50 or 60 in the season and the days are getting long, he's a driver. He's intense, he's competitive, and a very good leader. So I think he was a great pick for captain for the team, and I think you can see it in his play, and I think he excels even more when he has that responsibility and that that pressure. Like it just drives him.
Speaking of the Jets leadership core, I mean, you've seen the evolution of Mark Scheifele. What's it like to see where he is now as a player?
I think it's great, because like I remember when Chase first came into the league, and he's just such a wide-eyed, innocent rookie, but he's just such a good person. I think he's another guy like Blake, who's just very competitive and very driven, and they both just want to be the best players they can be, and they feed off each other. They push each other to get better, and they train together in the off season, and they're always pushing each other. And I think like it's so important to have that kind of competitiveness and drive at that level, to keep getting better and to keep improving. And so to see Scheifele have the success he's having, I mean, I'm definitely not surprised. And I think there's still so much more left in the tank, but I'm really happy for him. He's such a great person, and he deserves it.
In terms, I got to go back to, man, it's Last Dance week, I guess. But is there such thing as, in your time there, a Winnipeg Jets version of Scottie Pippen, who's absorbing the intensity of the Michael Jordan-esque competitive leadership? Is there that analogy? Does it go that far?
I don't know. That's a tough one. So, like, you're talking like a Mark Scheifele, Blake Wheeler, Pippen, MJ kind of comparison. I don't know. Maybe.
Might be forcing it. I got to be honest, but I wanted to throw it out there for you.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough one. I think they're their own people. They're their own athletes, but they definitely feed off each other, I think, and they both drive each other, push each other to get better every day. And I'm not even around the rink every day, so I don't see it all the time. But from what I've seen, it's pretty clear. And I think having two guys like that leading the charge and kind of creating that pace, setting the pace, it's really good for the rest of the team.
Just going back, Grant, I mean, obviously you knew Claude Noel from your time in Columbus. I mean, how would you describe the coaching change in Winnipeg? I mean, where you were familiar with one guy and then what Paul maybe brought to the table when he took over?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had a few coaching changes in my career, and it's interesting how teams react. I think there's always different personalities at the coaching level, but also the player level, and how those players react to different personalities as coaches. I think Paul brought a lot of structure and very good motivator, very kind of like firm, structured. You knew where you stood. You knew what to expect. He's another guy who's intense and competitive, but I mean, also came with like so much experience, pro coaching experience, and I had a lot of respect. I have a lot of respect for Paul. I think I learned a lot from him when I was there, even though it wasn't that long. And it was interesting because when I came back from my first surgery, so he kind of took over right when I got injured the first time. I think I was on my way to LA to have surgery when I found out that Claude got let go. And I really liked Claude. I had Claude in Columbus as well when Hitchcock got fired there. Claude took over, and he was my first NHL coach. So, I mean, he's such a fun, high energy character. I think he brought a lot of levity to the ring, kind of like what Bob has, but also competitive and also a really good coach, very personable and approachable. So I have a lot of respect for both of those guys. So I kind of had to, I guess, prove myself to Paul when I came back after my first injury. And so that was interesting. That was kind of the beginning of our relationship, really. I mean, I had seen him around the rink and stuff when I was rehabbing, but until you're actually playing for someone, you don't really have that same dynamic. So it was like anything, you kind of got to prove yourself all over again and then show what you bring to the team and how you can do that consistently. And then it felt like I was starting to earn his trust and starting to play some more and more minutes. And then unfortunately I got hurt again, and that was the last one. But no, he was a motivator. I mean, his pregame speeches were awesome. Every time he's done saying I'm going through a wall. And I really enjoyed my experience with both of them.
How common is it, the pregame speech? Like, how often does that meet movie standards? With a guy who communicates as well as Paul, you'd imagine fairly often, but what's it like in the trenches for real?
It really depends on the coach. And, you know, some of them are, you know, great coaches and great motivators, but the speeches become a little bit repetitive sometimes, I think. And I'm not just talking about pro hockey, but any hockey I've played. After a certain while, I mean, you're talking to the team every second day, and it's easy to be repetitive. And then sometimes maybe it loses a little bit of the emphasis or the purpose, but you still get the message across. And I think, you know, as an athlete, you got to be prepared to play no matter what. But with Paul, it was impressive because he was so calculated in his speeches and so purposeful. And I think what really impressed, how I've been in so many pregame speeches or team meetings or whatever, where you're addressing the team a lot. So to be different every time, that's a skill. It just shows a lot of preparation and thoughtfulness. And it sometimes can meet the standard of the movie image, but it takes a good motivator to do that. But I would say Paul did that numerous times for sure.
Last one for me, Grant. I mean, what was your experience with Charlie Huddy like?
I like Huds a lot. He's just, again, kind of like a quiet, very approachable, very personable, but so intelligent. Like, just, you know, guy who had such a successful playing career and then followed up with such a great coaching career. And I had him for a while in Winnipeg, and He was really good for me on taking the time to work on little details, and is very good with video and pointing out little things that make such a big difference in the course of a game. And then just being like an even keel back there. I think he's one of those guys, he never gets too riled up. He's really good at making sure you keep an even keel, and good at reading the bench. I think that's probably an underrated skill as a coach, is the ability to see, you know, go in this game, who's not, and how do we manage that, and how do we, you know, somebody had a bad shift or made a big mistake, you know, throw them back out, or if someone's really having a tough night, maybe we need to, you know, dial it back a little bit. And so he's good at that. He's just somebody I felt like I could talk to, and taught me a lot.
I think I'll just ask a quick follow-up on that, and then say a huge thank you, Grant. It seems everything we ask you gets met with such a thoughtful and detailed response, and that's just such a treat for us, I'm sure. In terms of reading the bench, one of the things that it seems always happens with the Jets is that if you look at the even strength ice time at the end of the game, it's always neatly ordered. You could line up Bufflin on the second pair, but he would always be number one by the end, and then maybe Trouba would be behind him, and Morrissey and Myers, and it would always seem to follow such a precision. And I'm wondering, this is kind of an awkward last question, but how does that end up happening in terms of what order people get tapped on the shoulder in?
Well, I think there's quite a few things at play when you talk about that. When you talk about ice time and managing a game, definitely the caliber of the player and their kind of role on the team in a depth chart, if you will, like how they're expected to play and perform. But then their consistency and how able are they to perform at the level they're expected to perform at regularly. Because I think ice time, to me anyways, tends to indicate consistency. Because if you're out there not playing the way you should play, you're not going to get the ice time that you're expected to get. And then another one I think is trust and confidence. So as a player, like I mentioned before, you kind of have to earn that with your coaches, and you have to build that over time. And as you build that, you get a little bit more leeway for if you're not playing as well as you should be, or if you do make a mistake here or there, because they know your track record, they know what you've done, they know what you can do, and they expect you to recover from that and to, you know, be playing the way you should be playing. So I think as you develop that confidence and trust, the coaching staff tends to just be more comfortable putting you in certain situations because they've seen what you can do, and they trust that you'll do the job. So I think all those factors kind of go into play when it comes to ice time and play. But at the end of the day, as a professional, you have to be ready to do your job, and you're only as good as your last shift. And so if you're not showing up prepared and you're not playing well, coaches aren't going to keep playing you just because. You have to earn that. So I think there's a lot of emphasis on professionalism and consistency of the player as well.
Thank you for that. Thank you for the thoughtfulness behind that and all of your responses and all of the thoughts that you had to share today, Grant. Ken and I were both so happy to have had you on.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime, guys. Really great talking to you.
Awesome. Thanks, Grant. That was really good, man. Thank you. Appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thoughtful as always from Grant Klitsam. We've had the opportunity. Ken, you've covered him for years, and I was able to have a recent feature go up at The Athletic talking about Grant's work helping athletes transition out of their professional careers, athletes of all sports, but mostly NHL players. He's also a harken back to a time when Winnipeg was a little bit deeper on defense than maybe it was at times this season. I know, Ken, you're doing a look into what Winnipeg's options might be, and I'm wondering what you see on the horizon for the Jets right now in terms of rebuilding the back end.
Yeah, it should be interesting. I mean, in some ways, the Jets will be looking for the next kind of Grant Klitsam type. I mean, the guy who came in, you know, not with a lot of fanfare, but by the end of it was on the, you know, essentially on the top pairing with Dustin Bufflin. So I do think they're going to be active, whether it be via trade or free agency. We're certainly going to look at a number of different options there. And I know you'll be handling the center position. So Yeah, exciting times. I mean, it's great to catch up with Grant and can remember him showing up and arriving on the scene. And, you know, you could tell pretty early that this was a guy who was pretty insightful and had a lot of interests, both loves the game of hockey, but also was always interested in talking, just shooting the breeze. And that's something that is always appreciated from our standpoint as well.
Actually, let me back up. How did he become new guy? What's the story there?
Oh, that was the Rick Ralph. That was the Rick Ralph nickname that basically stuck. And I know we didn't throw it in there during the conversation, but I'm sure it would have brought a chuckle from Grant. Just, you know, the guy claimed off of waivers, and Rick one day on the show used that term new guy, and it kind of stuck. And I'm not sure if his teammates called him that, but certainly members of the media occasionally use that reference. But yeah, just a great individual. And, you know, I would expect that given his life experience and interests, he would thrive in that position of helping athletes with the transition, because you're not going to go through, as you wrote, I mean, you can't go through much more of a difficult transition than the one that Klitsen himself went through. I mean, he gave such great perspective on how he handled it, but it would be very easy to do the opposite of what Klitsen did and to feel, you know, sorry for yourself and not look at the positives about being able to carve out a 205-game NHL career and instead wonder what might have been had he not suffered a debilitating injury as he did.
Now, there's a lot of different routes that can be taken after that transition from the top pair to the sidelines, and it seems that he's taken the best of it to be sure. One of the things that I really find like the most compelling about it all is that when he goes about his work now, you know, he's almost immediately seen as real, right? He has the cred of having gone through it. And I think that actual experience and being able to relate to the players that he's talking to means a lot to them. I asked him what the formula is. What's the initial conversation like? And like any good advisor, he said, well, it depends on the situation. And it depends on what that person's going through and what pieces of my experience I'm able to relate to that or how well I know them. And I just think that it's one of those great examples of attitude determining aptitude as time goes by. And so, definitely look forward to more coverage of what he's up to as time goes by. Ken, for the time being, I guess the last thing to touch on, the NHL is all about return to play scenarios right now and the possibility of whether it's 24 teams or what have you. It seems like no matter what would happen, if there's a safe return to play, Winnipeg's close enough on that cusp that they would be involved in the process to cut it down to its 16-team playoffs. Do you have a preference? Does anything make more sense to you about what the NHL could do at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that some of our colleagues aren't totally in favor of 24 teams, and don't look at it as 24 teams making the playoffs. I think there will be 24 teams involved in the return, and then they'll trim down to that 16 number. And for me, I think, to be perfectly honest, it's the only fair way to do it, because you can't assume that teams are going to win games in hand. I mean, I understand points percentage and all that thing. I have no problem with the mathematics of it, but you just can't assume a team is going to win those games. So, I mean, I would be saying this whether the Jets were involved or not, but you can't penalize a team for having played more games because those were the games on their schedule. And by virtue of their schedule, the Jets were a playoff team. And yes, it's possible that they may have been passed. It's also possible they may have passed the Dallas Stars. So I think that I also have no problem whatsoever with teams like Montreal, the New York Rangers, and the Chicago Blackhawks being involved. This is about trying to recoup some of the lost revenues and having three teams who also were technically still close enough to be in the race involved is going to be good for the sport. And I mean, is it a coincidence that three of those teams are in very large markets and are original six teams? In this case, yes, it is a coincidence, but getting the game back safely is the most important thing, and having 24 teams involved when there were anywhere between 7 and 11 games left in the regular season, I have absolutely no problem with that.
I have to admit to a certain degree of cynicism on my part. I really do think that those huge markets, and just like you said, I mean, money being such an important part of the process right now, coincidence or no, whatever the gray area of that is, I'm cynical enough to be like, hey, you know what, those markets, if I'm the NHL right now and I'm thinking about recouping some money, I look at them and I kind of get my eyes light up a little bit. Let's make sure that they're involved in some way, shape, or form. Of course, they wouldn't make it a ridiculous if they were in 28th, 29th, 30th, whatever it is, right? But that's something that enters my perspective. I think, of course, you also made the most important point, which is that it's about safety and still continues to be. And the NHL continues to make its plans based on the possible reality that the league is able to return safely. And we'll always be waiting and watching and seeing for that. Ken, I'm not going to give you a chance to rebut that. I'm just going to say to all the listeners out there in the world, thank you for listening to the Boarding Pass this week. Please check out our comment section for each podcast episode. You can find that at the Athletic app. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the Boarding Pass on Apple. If you click on the show's URL, theathletic.com/theboardingpass, you'll get 40% off your subscription to The Athletic. So for Ken Weeb, I'm Murat Atesh. Thank you for listening.